Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Andrew Morris discusses the unprecedented demand for affordable housing in the mid-1940s and 50s created by returning World War II veterans, resulting in dramatic growth of U.S. suburbs. Professor Morris explains that with the combination of the Great Depression and the rationing of materials for World War II, new homes were not being built in significant numbers. As thousands of veterans came home and started families, coupled with an economic upswing, the demand for new housing skyrocketed. This hour-long class took place at Union College in Schenectady, New York.
Okay, let's get started. Thank you all for being here bright and early and on time for our 8 o'clock class. What I'm going to try to do today is pull together three of the big themes that we've been examining so far this term in our look at the post-war United States and the United States in the context of the early Cold War. The first of those themes are these changes in the American family that we were talking about on Monday, particularly the post-war baby boom, and the many ways in which Americans are struggling and thinking about the proper role of women in family life and in national life, the proper role of men, all of those themes and those tensions about what's happening with families. So that's one of the things I want to try to address today. The second strand I'd like to pull in are some of these changes in the post-war American economy that we've looked at several times over the course of this term, and particularly the ways that these economic and technological innovations made during World War II spill out into the post-war economy and become elements of the post-war economic boom that we've explored a little bit and will continue to explore the rest of the class. So that's the second one, is sort of the spillover from the war into post-war prosperity. And then the third is this theme of economic security that we've been looking at time and again during the course of this term, and particularly the ways that Americans' expectations about economic security shift after the war, and the ways in which they look to government in certain ways to help guarantee that kind of economic security. So these themes of family, of economic shifts and post-war prosperity, and these concerns about economic security, I want to draw them all together by looking at one of the most distinctive landscapes of the post-war United States, and that is the suburbs. So as you know, as I like to do often in this class, I want to give you guys a flavor of the kind of thing we're going to be talking about by sharing with you some visual evidence from the period. The clip I'm going to show you here, it's about a minute long, is from a 1957 film called In the Suburbs. This was actually an advertising venue created by Red Book, which was a mainstream women's magazine in the 1950s. Very typical of these magazines you're going to be reading selections from for our discussion for tomorrow. So if you're thinking about those, this is really sort of representative of that outlook. This is a pitch that Red Book was making in 1957 to potential advertisers. And what they're trying to do to advertisers is to convince them that Red Book is a great venue through which these advertisers could reach these booming suburban populations in the 1950s. But in this, you'll see, is just a great sort of visual explanation of at least how Red Book viewed the suburbs and what was going on in the suburbs. So we'll just take a brief look here so you can get a flavor for that, and maybe we'll just discuss it kind of very briefly about what you see going on here. So let me just step over and get this started.
Oh, no!
Discouraged? Disgruntled? Heck no. They're glad to be here. Remember? So they join the stream of family life in the suburbs, soon to become part of its familiar sights, soon to absorb its familiar sounds.
Anybody home?
So unfortunately, I can't play you all 15 minutes worth. We will, if we have some time, come back to another clip from this. Again, I think it's one of the great, best sort of nonfiction visual representations of post-war suburbia. Anything strike you about the way that the suburbs in the mid-50s are presented by the filmmakers here? Techniques they use to sort of talk about the suburbs or images? Anything jump out at you from this this little clip here? Yeah, Hutton?
I mean, as you go along, I'm sorry, the music's... was like kind of dim at first and like mm-hmm. dull and everything, and then it started to pick up when we started going towards the suburbs, and then that music got all cheery and happy when we went into the suburbs, so it was like happy family life in the suburbs.
Right, so you've got this very deliberate filmmaking contrast there between the sort of bleak, dreary, that sort of the soundtrack of before the suburbs, and then you've got the sort of happy, jaunty music, and we're literally kind of driving through there. Great, Claire?
And it sort of parallels the entire sequence of war and peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's the chaos of the war, and then it's like, well, the war's over now, so you don't have to be in a frenzy. You can relax, and you can raise a family in peace and happiness.
Right, literally those dark days of the end of the war, the immediate post-war era that's literally in black and white, shift to color, and we get the suburbs. Yeah. Victoria?
Oh yeah, I was actually gonna go along with the color and just uh-huh. say that I think it was like emblematic of like the technological advancements of the time.
Sure.
How it switches back.
Absolutely, and we are in a period now in the late 1950s where Americans are actually getting used to seeing moving pictures in color. It does sort of underscore that sense of progress and that sense of optimism, that another thing that we have traced throughout this term as well. Okay, well, we'll come back and look a little bit more at the suburb, but just to give you a flavor for how many Americans kind of were feeling about this and how the move to the suburbs was presented, that kind of, again, that sort of jaunty, optimistic sense that things were getting better for Americans in the United States. One of the things that happens in this period that we're going to be talking about today, and it's a statistic I've given you earlier in the class, is that during the period of the expansion of the suburbs, America moves from a nation of renters. In the 1930s, most Americans did not own their own homes, or the majority of Americans did not own their own homes, to a nation of homeowners. So by the early 1960s, the majority of Americans actually do own their own homes. And the reason why we get that fundamental transformation, many people able to finally achieve what they considered the American dream of homeownership, has a lot to do with the dynamics that we're going to be talking about today. So that's one of the things we're going to be looking at here. Okay, so let me just bring up the PowerPoint presentation and give you a sense of kind of where we're at in right at the end of the wartime era and what's going on with America and Americans and where they live. In 1946, 1947, right at the end of the war, America was facing a housing shortage, a really, really dire housing shortage for a number of reasons. First, during the 1930s, the Great Depression, the construction industry was one of the areas of the economy that was hardest hit, and home building grinds to almost a virtual halt during the Great Depression. So there's not a lot of houses that are being built during the 30s. And then similarly, during World War II, although obviously, as we know, it's a much more prosperous era, you have all of those restrictions due to the war on all sorts of material. A lot of things that went into the building of houses are actually channeled into the wartime defense economy. So that slows down the sort of normal pace of what we would have expected in terms of home building. So there's not as many houses being built really over kind of since 1929, a 16-year period. And then you get this massive wave of veterans coming home. You know, there's 12 million people that served in the armed forces during World War II. And as we've seen on Monday in talking about the baby boom and changes of families, a lot of them come home to get married and to very quickly have kids. So you've got a decreased supply. You've got an increased demand, And those two forces come together to really put a pinch on what's available in terms of housing. Again, let me show you another clip. This is from a 1946 newsreel put out by the Time Life Corporation. This is the March of Time. We've seen a couple of these before. And this gives you sort of a dramatized news look at how the housing shortage was playing out for kind of typical Americans in 1946, again, right in the middle of this crunch. So let me just play this for you. It's, again, about a couple minutes, I think.
But the housing problem of the average veteran is still far from a satisfactory solution.
Okay.
Today, almost 2 million are forced to double up with parents or in-laws, biding their time more or less patiently until the day when they can begin to lead their own lives.
This was in 1918, just before the armistice. My top sergeant was a fellow by the name of McClinchy. You see, our company had been a divisional reserve in a town called, what was that name? Funny, I should remember it. It wasn't Mazeres, because we moved into Bellow after that.
You naughty, bad girl.
Mother, please. How many times have I got to ask you not to speak to her that way?
I suppose it's all right if she wrecks the house.
She's only doing what's natural for a child.
Of course, I don't know anything about children. I've only brought up four of my own.
Well, like I said, this was in 1918, just before the armistice. My top sergeant is a fellow by the name of McClinchy. He came from South Bend. Used to be a plumber before the war. And what'd he mean?
So a kind of humorous dramatization of the situation that many Americans, especially veterans coming back from the war, would have found themselves in 1946 or 1947. People are forced to do what these families are doing, double up oftentimes, move in with in-laws, and that's of course the dramatic tension you see here, and these new families, you know, people sort of stretching their wings and running up against cramped space and perhaps having to deal with people looking over your shoulder for your child rearing techniques. You can see here in this in the way that this Chicago Tribune cartoon captures this as well, the tensions there really structured between the sort of hopes for family life that many Americans, and especially again young families starting after the war, were running into, the restrictions that the housing shortage seemed to provide. It's also one of the reasons, and looking back to our discussion of the GI Bill, that here at Union College in the late 1940s, the college actually had to go out and build married student housing for many of these veterans that were coming back to Union College to resume or to start their education, but veterans who had married in the interim. One, the college just didn't have a lot of housing for married students. But two, the housing market in Schenectady was so tight that these families had trouble finding apartments to live with their new families. So it's just a kind of local example of some of the workarounds that places like Union had to do, at least in the short term, to try to meet these problems of post-war housing. The housing shortage, though, presented an incredible business opportunity as well. And entrepreneurs in the late 1940s are brainstorming ideas about the ways in which they can tap into this obvious, almost desperate market for housing after World War II. And many of them are thinking about the ways that they could take technological innovations that were made during the war and apply them to this problem of building houses. So we've already seen some examples of the way that techniques like mass production influence and change the dynamics of a range of industries during World War II. We've seen it in pharmaceuticals, and we've seen it all the way to shipbuilding, the Liberty ships, that example I talked about before. And so housing, as it turns out, is one of those places where they find a perfect fit between these new techniques and this problem of getting a lot of houses built quickly to meet these new demands. Already in 1946, you see media sources sort of speculating on how and which techniques developed during the war might be channeled or directed towards the housing shortage. And I want to go back and show you again another short clip from this March of Time documentary to see in 1946 how people, how at least journalists were thinking about the different ways that these new techniques might be applied. So again, let me just play you another short clip here from the March of Time.
Next and most important step was to speed up building by new methods through which permanent homes could be built in a fraction of the usual time at a fraction of the usual cost. These new building techniques range all the way from giant machines which deposit whole houses like massive eggs to the less spectacular but more tested method of prefabrication, by which houses are built sectionally in factories and assembled on the site. It is to prefabrication, making the fullest use of assembly line methods and new materials developed during the war, that housing experts look with greatest hope. Most striking development is a revolutionary low-priced home designed by Buckminster Fuller for mass production. With their present potential, the nation's aircraft plants could turn these out at the rate of 2 million a year.
But Mr. Fuller, why a roundhouse?
Why not? The only reason houses have been rectangular all these years is that that is all it could do with the materials we had. Now, with modern materials and technology, we can apply to houses the same efficiency of engineering that we apply to suspension bridges and airplanes. A ventilator on top can induce a complete air change every 6 minutes. Air conditioning and heating cost only a quarter as much as in an ordinary house. Here is the living room. Its window is 40 feet long. These are the two bedrooms, each with its own bath. And the kitchen, complete with the refrigerator.
Okay, so there's, again, plenty more of that I think is also interesting. And again, just very quickly, anything strike you about, again, this sort of speculation of what housing post-war might look like? Yeah, Nick.
How they portray like the machinery and what they're building with, like the advancement of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Trucks. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Like the big trucks and things.
Yeah, I mean that's one of my favorite part of this. I mean, and talk about a dead end that didn't really happen. I mean, you go to a housing site today, you do not see giant wheeled machines sort of depositing houses like that. But speculating forward, it made perfect sense in thinking about, again, the way that the shipbuilding industry or something might have done. So yeah, there's one dead end that didn't happen out of this. Great. Anything else jump out at you? Yeah, Joe?
Just kind of the circular house. I'm not really sure whether or not that ended up being applicable, like, you know, at the time. Uh-huh. But it was certainly cool because it was like, we have the ability to do it, so why not do it?
Right, right. And it is, you know, just in the way that we've looked at sort of other speculation about technological advancement, like for atomic energy or something. This is one of those things that's sort of looking forward and almost sort of a fantasy of what would happen. Didn't actually pan out. But you can see the way that, again, they're trying to make the connections between the techniques that were used during the war and thinking about ways to push them forward. Great. Anything else? Yeah, Nick.
Sort of how they are switching from military production and using those same techniques for the domestic economy now.
Yeah, and especially that last piece there, the Buckminster Fuller. Buckminster Fuller, by the way, was a noted experimental psychologist, but also sort of a kind of a social visionary here. And you can get a sense of almost from that he's a little bit kind of out there, sort of speculative, but in a very grounded way, like many people, thinking about how you take this productive capacity of the war machine and flip it over into the civilian economy. You don't get Buckminster Fuller's roundhouse, but you do get some examples, literally, of trying to turn the machines of war into the products of peace. And I want to just briefly show you, this is sort of a little known story of another one of these dead ends of trying to experiment with the ways of applying these wartime manufacturing techniques to the problem of post-war housing. It's the story of the Lustron home. Great name. Most of the photos I get from here are from a website about a really interesting documentary on Lustron homes. So I've given you the link there if you want to fill it. Lustron homes were prefabricated stainless steel houses made literally in old airplane plants that had been used during the war. And using prefabricated parts, stainless steel panels coated with enamel, created these kits that could be trucked in on site on the back of a truck like that and used to produce a modest but attractive new home pretty quickly and relatively cheaply. What strikes me about this and also about the Buckminster Fuller example that you've seen before is, again, this is almost the most concrete way you can see people trying to take those wartime plants and retool them. In some ways, if you think back to that classic 1946 film that we saw at the beginning of the term, The Best Years of Our Lives, the ways in which the bombers that have been scrapped from the war play such a symbolic role in that movie, which we've talked about before. And in that next to the last scene in the movie, you've got the former bomber pilot sitting in that scrapyard with all of those discarded tools of war. And what's happening? Anyone remember what's kind of going on in that scrapyard while Fred Derry is sort of thinking back? Yeah, Carly?
Man comes in and says that they're scrapping them all to make new houses.
Absolutely. So this is almost literally, you could almost literally imagine Fred Derry going to work for the Lustron Corporation in whatever the name of that town was. I mean, literally that conversion from peace to war. And you've got this great, I mean, one of the nice things about these sort of late 40s and early 50s stuff is the way that they're playing with color, not just in moving pictures, but a lot of these, these ads for these new housing developments, you really feel that kind of rich color. So this is a sort of interior shot of a Lustron house. If anyone's actually ever curious to see what one of these looked like, there's actually a couple over in Scotia. So if you want to go do a self-directed field trip just a few miles away, you can check out what these actually look like. They're actually collector's items now. There's Lustron house owners groups all over the web. You can get on there. But as a solution to the housing crisis, it was somewhat of a dead end. The main problem was that even though they got the costs down through these techniques of mass production, it tapped out at about $11,000 a house, which was still a financial reach for many Americans during the war. And for a variety of reasons, they couldn't get it any cheaper. And so ultimately, the company went bankrupt by the late 40s and early 1950s. But again, a sort of, the story that didn't happen, the sort of, again, another dead end here of the way in which these entrepreneurs are thinking about taking these techniques and trying to get a piece of this housing market. William Levitt, a builder in Long Island, someone you guys have read about for today, is the guy that figures out the technique that actually works and that would become the basis of the post-war housing boom and the post-war suburban landscape. As you've read, Levitt found a more successful solution to the problem than Buckminster Fuller's roundhouse or the Lustron home or the giant egg-laying wheeled machinery. He was a builder before the war, as you guys have read in this article for today from Time magazine for the 1950s. And as a builder, as a contractor, he knew that one of the things that was preventing Americans from getting into homes was simply the high price of housing in general. Prior to World War II, most houses were built individually by skilled labor, often in building trades unions, who got paid relatively high prices, or high wages, I should say. And that if you added up all of the pieces that went into your average, say, 1930s house, about 2,000 different items that you needed to build a house. So it's a complicated process, it needs a lot of expensive skilled labor, and it takes a fairly long time. So Levitt realizes that that's sort of one of the things holding Americans back, because all of those added up to a relatively high cost for housing. And so during the war, and as you've read for today, he gets involved in trying to build housing for defense workers in cities like Norfolk, Virginia. He's experimenting with different techniques to figure out how to simplify the process and how to get those costs down to make these houses more affordable. And by the end of the war, by 1945, 1946, he's kind of put things together such that he's ready to go. He and his family, the Levitts, are a family business. There's a father and two brothers. Bill, I think as the article conveys, is sort of the front man. His father was a successful builder as well. His brother was an architect, so they all got a finger in it. But William Levitt was really the front man of this. The Levitt family buys 4,000 acres of potato fields out in Long Island. How many people are from Long Island here? One, just one. It's hard to imagine, at least me personally, that Long Island was once basically farmland, but it was a major source of potatoes for New York City up until the 1950s. So there's a lot of open space still on Long Island in the late 1940s. Levitt and his family buy up thousands of acres, and this is what they do with it. It's a nice aerial view of what would become the first Levitt town. These images, by the way, are from a great website designed by a guy named Peter Hales, who's at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He's got a great sort of photo essay about early Levitt Town. So again, if you're interested in looking at more images, I've given you, as we go along, some of the websites you can, his web address, you can track back to that. Okay, so you guys have read a little bit. I mean, Levitt now is a familiar name to you. You've read this magazine, this Time article from 1950 that's really picking up on the Levittown phenomenon as it's unfolding. How would you describe the techniques that Levitt, as a builder, used to try to put this development together quickly and cheaply? What kind of things is going on here in the building of Levittown? Yeah, Hutton.
It goes back to like the wartime efforts where everything is being like assembly lined almost.
Uh-huh.
And I think it talks about one time, or at one point, they were talking about trucks just dropping bundles of like supplies, just a bundle of everything you need in one big rolled up thing.
Right.
And then the builders would come and assemble it all, and it'd be cheaper and quicker than anything that's done before.
Right. So the idea of the assembly line technique, and literally sometimes Levitt was called the Henry Ford of housing. Looking back to that original pioneer of assembly line methods in automobiles in the 19-teens, several decades before, and now, decades later, thinking about how this might be applied to a very, very different production process. Great. So you've got this sort of sense of an assembly line, that things are being done in order, in pieces, in a row. Great. Anything else jump out at you about the strategies that Levitt used here in the building of Levittown? Yeah. Emily.
Mainly used ranch-style homes that are concentrated on the first floor.
Okay, yeah, so these, you know, your typical house in the 1930s, I don't know, typical, but oftentimes most houses built in the 20s or 30s were at least two stories. It's a lot more complicated to make two full stories than one full story. So a lot of his houses started out at least with just a single floor, either in his sort of basic Cape Cod little square houses, we'll show a plan of that in a minute, or these ranch houses that become a lot more typical. You had the option of adding on a floor if you wanted to as a homeowner, but just that focus on the sort of most simple design also was a thing that speeded things up. Great. Ryan.
The focus on specialization of labor, so you could focus on a few different houses at a time and just hire different people to come in, like for different housing, because you can't focus on just, you can't just build one house. It takes time for everything to develop.
Right, right. Yeah, so much in the same way that Henry Ford did with the assembly line, part of the savings of the assembly line comes with breaking down the task that a skilled laborer did. So for Henry Ford, it would have been, you know, someone who was a machinist, who was experienced in, you know, different aspects of you know, metalwork or something like that, breaking it down in the car making process to somebody who did not have a lot of training and could be paid more cheaply. Similarly, with Levitt, he breaks it down, and I think I've got another picture here, to a process where somebody who's not, say, a skilled mason, or somebody who's not a unionized carpenter who's been doing it for 30 years, could still put these together quickly and efficiently. So breaking down those tasks from one that required a lot of skill to one that was relatively simple and not necessarily unskilled, but as they would describe it, maybe as semi-skilled. And you could pay those guys less. So breaking that down. Great. Anything else jump out at you? Hillary.
I think what he was able to do that the company used in the 40s wasn't was he bought from the manufacturers directly. So he was able to make the houses more affordable for people. And then he was also selling them more of a community than just the house because there was the recreational facilities.
Right, right. So two strategies there. I mean, one of the things that is so remarkable and striking about Levittown in particular is the scale of building that's going on. When Levittown was done, and Levittown itself is not just one town, it's spread across different townships in Rhode Island, but that development as a whole had 17,400 houses in it. It was the single largest housing development ever in time, I mean, up until that point. So that kind of volume gave Levitt a lot of leverage with manufacturers. And again, you know, whether you're buying appliances or whether you're buying 2x4s, that kind of scale allows you to get cheaper prices, and that, of course, gets reflected in the price of the home. Great. Yeah, and then the selling point, the other selling point, beyond the manufacturing side, but what is it sort of, what is living in the suburbs going to mean? And offering it as a community rather than as sort of an individualized house. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we think about sort of daily life in the post-war suburb. Okay, great. Anything else jump out at you sort of about the sort of techniques? Striking, interesting, the way that that Levitt lays those out?
I think at one point he was talking about the stove. Everyone was having a three-burner stove, and they decided that, or someone came up to him and was like, oh, I could find this four-burner stove, it'll fit the same, and for not that much more of a price. So he said, okay, throw out all the three-burner stoves, and we'll put all four-burner stoves in all the houses from now on. So, I mean, just that buying from the manufacturer and just upgrading at a pretty much cheaper price. I think they said it was like only $4.25 to upgrade from the three-burner to the four-burner. So he upgraded, and everyone was happy after that.
Yeah, and also it's an indication of sort of, you know, again, Levitt and his brother and father's entrepreneurial mindset. They don't take the way it's been done as a given. I mean, everyone just sort of assumed you need the three burner stove. Why not put a four burner in for a little bit more, but you're going to sell more houses, people are more attracted to it. So again, just thinking of sort of, I mean, thinking outside the box, not my favorite phrase, but thinking non-traditionally about this process coming from the outside and not just taking things as they had been traditionally done. And Levitt is a great example of that. He built these houses fast, and he built them cheap, and the article describes them. But I think at the fastest point, when they did a sort of test run of how quickly they could build it, they actually threw one of these houses up in about 16 or 17 minutes. So it's really the way all of these things that you guys mentioned, when sort of everything was coordinated well, the process of building a house, much like we saw the way that the time it took for a Liberty ship to get shrunk down, is really going fast. And just this picture, you can get a little bit of a sense, again, of that assembly line technique. If you look off in the distance, you can see those slabs for the foundations that are already poured. So presumably, if you'd come and visited the site when they were at in sort of full production, you would have seen guys, mostly guys, probably all guys, working as you went along, and you would see the stage of sort of each house in its different stage of development as each team was sort of moving along. So that's it gives you sort of a visual sense almost of how this assembly line technique worked there. So Levitt is classic entrepreneur. He is a classic sort of free market guy. But as you read in the Time Magazine article for today, he understands that there is a role for government. Anything strike you about how Levitt talked about what the government might do or could do in the housing market to help expand things? Yeah, Hillary?
He says that while he's solving kind of the middle class, there's still like the lowest bracket of income where the government needs to step in and build houses because those people just won't be able to afford anything.
Okay, so a couple interesting things there. One, these developments are solidly targeted to the middle class, or lower middle class, upper working class, it's still at the first, but he realizes this is not a solution for the poorest of the poor. There's no way he's going to be able to build a house that's going to be down to the level of the most destitute. So for one, he sees the role of kind of private industry of meeting this market, and maybe there's some government programs that could meet the needs of the poorest. And again, thinking back to Truman and Cold War liberalism, that idea of this sort of post-war economic vision that we've been exploring, that was certainly, the public housing was one of the things that, say, the Democratic Party was supporting at that time. I'm sorry, and the second thing you said?
How the government has to step in because the lowest bracket won't be able to afford housing.
Right, so he sees a necessary role for government in that sense. Great. Anything else jump out at you? Again, sort of how Levitt's thinking about what the government might be able to do, what the appropriate role of the government here in housing is? Yeah, Hutton?
I think it goes back to like his entrepreneurial demands and stuff. Mm-hmm. He doesn't think he can make houses, public housing, at a profit. So yeah, that goes back to free market and him trying to make a profit. So he decides that the government should step in and build it now.
Sure, yeah. So it's absolutely, there's only portions of this that are going to be actually profitable and attractive for private enterprise. Great. Anything else? Emily, did you have your...
Yeah, it said in the article that they like avoided the backing of unions, mm-hmm, and instead relied on the support of veterans, mm-hmm, and like the boost that they could get from the veteran support.
Sure. So reaching out especially to veterans and the ways in which, and he says it explicitly but also implicitly, those programs that the government are providing for returning veterans to help get them reestablished, readjusted, as that great word that we've used so far, into civilian life. So those programs that the government's playing for veterans is also quite interesting, and we've touched on that before. The other key role here, or a key element, I should say, in making this happen, are government programs such as those promoted by the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA for short. And what's important to note, and I think, and again, connecting back up to this broader theme of the ways in which Americans turn to government in certain ways to help expand economic opportunity and economic security, is the vital role that the government played in conjunction with people like Levitt to open up home ownership for people of modest means. And to understand that, you have to think about, again, going back to the 1930s and thinking about how housing and how buying a house worked prior to the late 1940s. Up through the 1930s, and this is actually programs that start during the Great Depression but really take off in the post-war era, if you wanted to buy a house and you didn't have, you know, $10,000 of cash in your pocket, you'd need to get a mortgage from the bank. Most banks at that time required, if you're going to take a mortgage, that you'd have to put a down payment of up to 50%. So literally, you had to walk in with half the cost of the house in your pocket, and then they would maybe consider lending to you if you passed, you know, all the requirements. The other part of it was that if you were able to get a mortgage, if you had that large down payment ready to go, the period for repayment, and most of these private bank loans, was quite short. Oftentimes, only 5 years or 10 years. And what that meant is that your monthly mortgage payment was relatively high. And for banks, this made perfect economic sense. I mean, lending to somebody is always a gamble. It's always a risk. There's a chance that people are going to default on the mortgage. And so the way that banks basically covered their bases was they wanted a lot of money up front, and they wanted that repayment to start pretty quickly so that if things went south, the bank would have something left. They'd get some money out of the transaction. And again, so in the sort of classic way that the housing market worked, or the banking industry worked in terms of mortgages, it made it quite hard for people of modest means to access home ownership. If you were a factory worker, maybe a well-paid factory worker, you know, maybe again a sort of skilled unionized worker, you would have to still save for years and years and years to be able to come up with that down payment. And then that large monthly mortgage payment, because that payback time was so short, may just push beyond what you're coming home with every month in your pay stub or in your pay envelope. So those factors, just those dynamics of what it took to actually get a mortgage and pay it back, was a severe restriction on people's ability, on people of modest means ability to participate in the housing market. So this is where the FHA, the government, step in and work with these changing dynamics of the housing market unleashed by people like Leavitt. What the FHA, one of the many things the FHA did, was basically guarantee mortgages. And without going into too many details about this, actually, how it actually worked, what they essentially told banks are, if people meet a certain qualification of income, and again, targeting people of modest means, if you agree to give them a loan with a relatively small down payment and a relatively long payback term, the federal government will guarantee those mortgages. So basically, the federal government will step in and assume some of that risk that the banks were so concerned about on the condition that the banks lower those barriers to entry for people, again, of modest means, people who are potentially want to buy houses but are just blocked out. So those down payments, if you had an FHA mortgage, those down payments could be as little as 5% of the cost of the house. And those mortgages might spread out to 20 years, 25 years, even 30 years. And so in some cases, for down payments as little as $400 and maybe as little as $56 a month, now you're sort of lower middle class, upper working class, person who have a regular job, who get a regular paycheck, but again, had a hard time accumulating that money up front, now this is a viable option for them. Now they can really think about home ownership and paying off a mortgage as something that's manageable rather than outside of their outside of the reach. And Leavitt, to his credit, realizes, and you can see a little bit of that in the article, that this is really a partnership. It speaks back to, again, that theme that we've been looking at in sort of the intersection of politics and economics, the ways in which government policies sort of shift to encourage, stimulate, and open access to the private economy. And we've seen that in a variety of ways. Government and business are not seen as opposed to each other in a way that they might have been in the 1930s. But here's a way that very clearly how government policies can be used to stimulate and actually open up the market for private entrepreneurs such as William Leavitt. All of this comes together very quickly in the late 1940s. The first offering of the first 1,400 homes that William Leavitt and his family put up for sale in Long Island sold out in 3 hours. And these offerings, openings for Levittown open houses, you would often see in the late 40s, lines and lines of people, people desperate to get out of these living situations with their in-laws, a lot of people cooped up in Brooklyn who really want to get out and find some space in Long Island. You'd see them lining up and eager to take advantage of these new opportunities. It's important to notice, too, that these are not dream houses. The first round of suburban housing that really the sort of typical houses of the late 40s and early 50s are actually quite small, especially compared to today's standards. Your average home size in the late 1940s is only about 980 square feet, whereas today it's more around about 2,200 square feet or so. So these are actually pretty small places, and especially these first houses, these little Cape Cod houses that were built by Leavitt. You can see there on the bottom is a typical floor plan. And it's essentially two bedrooms, a living room, and a kitchen, plus one bathroom. You could expand, like I mentioned, if there was a kind of unfinished attic, and a lot of people would eventually add on over time. And as you'll see in more contemporary views of Levittown, you see that people add on and do all sorts of things with these houses. But served up front is pretty modest. But even these modest houses, again, very small by today's standards, and were an incredible opportunity for these post-war Americans who had the means. You could see this playing out in our own backyard. And again, as I like to do, sort of think about the ways that that these dynamics are really nationwide. Levittown is the prime example. It's the textbook example of post-war housing. But just down the road, if you traveled, if you were here in Schenectady, capital region in the late 1940s, again, severe housing shortage in places like Schenectady, Troy, Albany. You've got a lot of these young families that are looking for places to move. A businessman, a developer from Long Island, watched what Leavitt was doing there in the late 40s, and he decided, like many people did, to try to copy Leavitt's techniques, to take his strategy and take it upstate. So if you were driving down Route 7, which is the highway that heads down to what's now the interstate, the Northway, towards Troy, you were down maybe about 6 miles from there in the late 1940s, you would have seen this new development going up that was called the Leavitt Town of the North. It was on the site of an old family farm owned by the Burns and Whitney families, and so they renamed the development the Burns-Whitney Estates. And the Burns-Whitney's Estates, which was built in the town of Colony, which is just next to where we are in Schenectady, mirrored a lot of the stuff that was going on in Levittown. It had that same sort of cookie-cutter design. I'll come back to that slide in a minute. So this is an aerial view now of Burns-Whitney. Again, almost you could almost just superimpose it on Levittown. It's a much smaller scale. There's only not thousands and thousands of houses, but still that sort of same pattern of kind of dense and close development there. The developers didn't use that same sort of really elaborate mass production techniques. I mean, you didn't, because it was a smaller scale, they didn't get those kind of returns to scale that you did before. But very clearly, it's the same kind of houses. And I encourage you sometime, if you're driving down Route 7, probably about half a mile before the interstate, before you get on the Northway, if you look to your left, you'll see, as you're going by, you'll see right on the side of Route 7, the first wave, the first line of these houses. And they look, again, there's still many of them, probably about five or six of them are still untouched. Most of them have been modified. But if you want to get a physical sense for what these houses look like, it's a really great local example. So I'd encourage you to keep your eyes open. Just quickly, let's go back to this this pamphlet. This is for the Burns-Whitney Estate, and I had offered this to you guys before to take a look at. This would have been, this is the local example, but it kind of mirrored the same kind of the same outreach that people like Leavitt would have been making and other developers were making across the country. What's your sense of who the target audience is? Can you pull out anything from looking at this about who the pitch that is being made here to? Yeah, Claire?
Married couples trying to build a family or just a young family in general.
Okay, what suggests that for you?
I mean, well, they talk about the kitchen and how you can watch the children playing, and there's a lot of bedrooms, so you can, expand your family.
Mm-hmm.
They have the yards, so all the things that you'd want if you were...
Great. Absolutely, yeah. So very much trying to make a pitch and an appeal to young families. So that's exactly who they envision occupying these places. Great. Anything else jump out at you again about the sort of selling points here that the Burns-Whitney Estates might offer to potential residents? Nick?
Possibly like the working class, because it says it has transportation to all the areas.
Mm-hmm.
To go to jobs.
Absolutely. So this is actually at a kind of transportation hub. If you see, there's a little map down there of where Route 7 meets Route 9. Notice there's no interstate there yet. But part of the vision is clearly working class people in in a society where car ownership is not completely universal. And probably on Monday, we'll talk a little bit more about how automobility intersects and helps drive the suburbs as well. Great. Joe?
Well, kitchens are kind of like one of the main points about this, and it kind of goes back to that consumerism and, you know, the 20-pound frozen food compartment so you can watch your I Love Lucy and that kind of stuff.
Right.
So it shows what's going on at the time, how kitchens and products are becoming more prevalent in our lives.
Absolutely. So this is really a preview of how significant the consumer economy is going to be. And if we have time right at the end here, I'll show a little bit of sort of how that was expressed in moving pictures here. But clearly all those listings of all the features is a very important part of the pitch here. Victoria.
Also in the kitchen, it kind of goes back to the gender roles. Like, it's a pitch to wives, you know, mm-hmm. to have this high-tech kitchen where they can run the home.
Right. So it's pretty obvious who they expect to be in that kitchen. The presumption is the woman's going to be there, and that she's probably going to be there most of the time and probably not working. Yeah, so it very much dovetails with this discussion that we've been having about the ways in which men's and women's roles are being rethought or reestablished in the post-war era. Great.
I think it's interesting how this is close to the heart of everything, and just because these families are settling for the suburbs doesn't mean they're missing out,
right.
And they can still engage in like all the activities that the cities might have,
uh-huh.
and like eventually get to the city if they want to.
Great, right. So you're not you can still participate in whether it's work or cultural activities, but you no longer are bound by living in these places. And cities like Schenectady and Troy were starting to be seen as sort of dirty and overcrowded. These new suburban developments offer all of these advantages of non-city living, but yet still close enough to get to, whether it's public transportation or increasingly, as we'll see, by the cars. Great. And one last thing let me just point out. If you look at the lower left-hand corner, which would have been the front of the pamphlet if it was folded up, they are specifically talking about veterans. And so again, it's young families, but often young families who will have had somebody in the service who can take advantage of both the FHA loans and also the specific advantages that the GI loans gave for people to get into these houses. Again, they're thinking again about how we can reach into these programs that are helping these people with modest incomes get into these houses. These the entry-level houses were a little under $8,000. That translates, I mean, depends, you know, what the how you calculate the value of the dollar. Probably translates into maybe $70,000 or so in contemporary money. So it's pretty cheap, even if you sort of calculate it forward. So these were, you know, again, they're small, but they're affordable. And if you take those innovations from the outside, from the private sector like Leavitt, and you marry it to these programs, those two things are really helping drive these opportunities here for young Americans. Anything else before I switch? Anything else you thought funny, interesting about about sort of the pitch here? Yeah, Claire?
Well, as a development, all the houses are pretty much the same and cookie cutter, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the very bottom, it's almost like a pitch to individuality, even with all the conformity. And it's like these houses might be the exact same, but you can pick the outside of it, so you can still be your own person.
Right. So at least to the extent that the color of your house represents some individuality, there is some room for it. And as we'll talk about, especially next week when we're going to be looking at some of these tensions between consumer society and these feelings or sense of increasing conformity in Americans' life in the 1950s, you see a lot of those tensions playing out in these suburban developments. They look all the same. They look cookie cutter. But also over time, you see people individualizing them in ways. And that's one of the things next week I'd like to unpack more, which is the sort of dominant thread that you guys see coming out of this. I want to pick up on this theme, and probably the last thing we'll do here today, about the way that families are thought of in these spaces. And we've already looked at, on Monday, the way that, you know, sort of family roles are being rethought. This is just a brief clip here from the beginning of an industrial promotion film. You'll see very quickly which industry is promoting it. It's not an industry that we see much of anymore, and that's part of why this is sort of striking and amusing. But the point I'm more interested in is sort of the assumptions that are being made in this portrayal of who's moving into these houses and what they're going to be doing in there. So let's watch this quickly. We'll take a few minutes to discuss it after you see it. The Asbestos Cement Products Association, no longer with us, unless perhaps in some lawsuit somewhere, but very much a part of post-war suburban construction.
You'll find a scene like this in nearly every village, town, and city throughout the country. For in the hopes and dreams of everyone, there's a home they can call their own. Home brings a sense of security to a man. Then to every woman, her home means a setting for gracious living. How do I know? Well, I'm a contractor. And over the years, I've helped a lot of people realize their dreams, building new houses and remodeling old ones too. And probably the most important step is the one these young people are going through right now.
And we'll have the living room right in here. And the kitchen right here, so we can see the children playing in the yard.
Yeah, the children. Children? Say, how many are you planning on? Not more than 6, I hope. Maybe I better add a few more rooms back here at that.
Silly. And we have shrubbery, of course, right along in here. And, oh, darling, it's going to be just perfect.
That's right. It's the planning that makes all the difference between happiness and headaches as the years go by. For instance, have you two decided what material to use on the outside walls?
Of course, that is the big question that everyone is concerned with here, or at least the Asbestos Siding Manufacturers Association is concerned with. There, as this goes on, you'll see all of the variety of wonderful asbestos siding options there were for you in the 1950s. And if you go by the Burns Whitney estate, you'll see there's still a couple of them that have the asbestos shingles on. But I think, obviously, what's sort of funny about this is the setup here, about the portrayal of who's going to be doing there. Again, anything jump out at you about this sort of picture that's painted here as the setup for your sort of typical suburban occupants of these suburban developments? Yeah, Nick.
Kind of seems like they have a lot of options.
Mm-hmm.
Like, compared to the other houses, like, we can have this here, this there. Talking about the outside, we can paint it like different ways.
Yeah. So this was made in 1952. So a few years into the building of these suburban places, and what you see in the 1950s is that you actually do get a lot more variety. The little cookie cutter ranch or Cape Cod houses really are typical of that early phase. By the 1950s, you get a wider range of people of different income levels who are looking to suburbanize, and there's a lot more effort to give people options, variety, and customization. Again, to reflect that kind of individuality that people could express. And so that putting things together, very much more typical of probably, you know, the mid-50s suburbs than, say, the 1947 suburbs. Great. Other things that jump out at you, again, about this sort of our little family conference that you see unfolding here and according to plan. Yeah, Josh.
It seems evident that times are good. Like, there's no fear. Like, you know, just, like, bring on more kids, bring on more rooms. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't seem to have a lot of concerns except that's just prosperity in the future.
Great, absolutely. So this is really, you know, as we were saying the other day, I mean, one of the things that's driving the baby boom is this sense of economic security, of prosperity that's going to go modeled right there. Maybe they're going to have 6 kids instead of that 3.2 or what have you, or the 2.4 that was the average prior to the war. But yeah, there's no sense of kind of concern. There's no sense of fear. Again, this is an industrial movie, so you probably wouldn't have them dwelling on how bad times were. But in fact, I think it represented a real reality for people. So great. Anything else that jumps out at you? Adam.
Just once again, plays to the roles between the husband and wife, how they're like, this is something a man can be proud of, mm-hmm. that he's providing for his wife. So it really shows how he's bringing in the money and, you know, he's just providing For the family, and the wife's just there to enjoy everything.
Right. So, and I mean, and you know, they tell us right from that for the man. So there's clearly a set of things that this is going to appeal to for men, and for the woman, there's a certain set of expectations about how she's going to explore and use that space. So it fits very neatly into those sort of stereotypical descriptions that we talked about, and we'll be unfolding a little bit more in our discussion for Friday. Great. Anything else? Striking, funny, interesting. Yeah, sorry, John.
It's kind of funny how they mention there's a variety of different asbestos materials that they could use. Mm-hmm. And in today's society, asbestos is basically death.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But it was a miracle product at that, and especially in terms of fireproofing and stuff like that. The health effects of asbestos, discovering that as a problem is decades off. So this is something that would have been used on the outside of your house. It would have been used on the inside of the house. It's in our basement from the 1920s. It's still all wrapped up there. But that, those sort of health concerns are way, way out on the horizon. Well, it certainly speaks to the way that these intersections about assumptions, or the intersection of these assumptions about families and who was going to live in these here. Here's just a family photo snapshot of one of these families in Burns Whitney. You've got the mom, you've got the little kid. And as the Burns Whitney flyer suggested, and as you can get a little bit of a sense from this clip, these were very much designed with a family in mind, and specifically the mom being at home with the kids. The early designs of the Levittown houses, the living room and the picture windows were on the front looking out to the street. But pretty quickly in most developments, they flip that around so that your big picture window is actually looking out into your backyard with a clear sight. And you can see if you're the mom standing in the kitchen, you can actually look through, if you're standing sort of in the corner, through the living room and through the plate glass window to see your kids in the backyard. So the assumption, again, is that this is a space that's going to be occupied primarily during the day by women, and it's assumed it's sort of built around the needs of these kids who are becoming really the definitive feature of these suburban places. Suburbia existed before the war. People had lived outside of cities, obviously, for decades, but it's really the post-war phenomenon that creates the suburban, largely suburban society that we have today. It is driven in part by this explosion of the housing market after the war. And if you want just a couple statistics to end and hang your hat on, you can see during the last years of the war, there were only 142,000 houses that were started. 6 years later, 2 million houses are started. So there's the sort of hard concrete facts of what this housing boom looked like. Most of that growth is taking place in the suburbs. 83% of the housing growth from 1950 to 1970, 83% from 1950 to 1970 was in the suburbs. And so the suburbs as we know it is really a product of this sort of hothouse combination of these different themes that we've been exploring today. The role, again, of families and the changing dynamics of families in the post-war era, the role that these technological innovations play in opening up new ideas about how to build these places, and the role that these new expectations and these new policies of the government of helping support those expectations. What we'll be doing in the next week or so is moving from here and looking at how these new suburban places connect back up to this larger consumer economy, the kind of things that you guys, that Claire, you touched on there, and the ways in which the suburban spaces help transform America into a much more resolutely consumer society. So we'll be picking up on that next week. Okay, well, that's it for today. Thank you all, and we'll see you bright and early on Friday.
Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in history are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.